From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the words and music of Stephen Sondheim, we talk with the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and lyricist whose shows include Sweeney Todd, Follies, Sunday in the Park with George, and Into the Woods. Also today, Memories of Amnesia. Lawrence Schoenberg tells us about his new novel, about a brain surgeon who finds his own brain has turned against him. The old supergroup concept has been revived in a new album featuring Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, and George Harrison. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of A Cry in the Dark, starring Meryl Streep. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When Stephen Sondheim was young, his mentor was his neighbor, the celebrated lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Now Stephen Sondheim is Broadway's foremost composer and lyricist, the one who more than anyone else has connected the Broadway tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein to the adventurous harmonies and dissonances of contemporary music. Sondheim is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, and he's the only composer-lyricist to win a Tony Award 3 consecutive years. His shows include A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, and the current hit, Into the Woods. Even if you're not familiar with those shows, you probably know his song, Send in the Clowns. Sondheim started on Broadway as a lyricist, collaborating with Leonard Bernstein on West Side Story and with Julie Stein on Gypsy. Sondheim rarely gives interviews, but today he was lecturing at the University of Pennsylvania in a series featuring writers affiliated with PEN, the International Writers Organization, and he paid us a brief visit. Sondheim told me that just before he started writing for Broadway, he worked as a writer for the TV series Topper.
I had earned some money. I was on a scholarship for 2 years after I got out of college, and when the money ran out, I needed a job. So I got a job writing as an assistant writer for the Topper series.
I have to tell you, that was about my favorite show when I was a kid. One of the greatest joy about getting sick was being able to stay home in the morning and watch the Topper reruns. Was that a useful learning experience for you?
Very, very. It's to learn to tell a story in 23 and a half minutes, in four acts, so that you have a teaser, and then three commercial breaks, and to structure each tiny little act so it has a sort of shape and has a punchline and an exit line for characters. And also the leading lady had trouble with her S's, so we had to try to keep plurals and plural verb, singular verbs out of the script.
It's a good writing exercise.
Very good indeed. No, it's very, very good. That kind of discipline is extremely useful.
Your first Broadway work was with Leonard Bernstein writing the lyrics for West Side Story.
No, I wrote the lyrics. He wrote the music. Oh, you said with Leonard Bernstein writing the lyrics.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah. There was no punctuation in that sentence. Yeah. You were writing the lyrics. He was writing the music.
Yeah.
You didn't like the idea of starting as a lyricist, though.
No, I was trained as a composer, and that's what I wanted to do. I'd majored in music, and I'd studied music on a scholarship with Milton Babber for 2 years. And it was an accident, and I wouldn't have done it except that Oscar thought it was a good idea for me to do it because Bernstein and Jerry Robbins and Arthur Lawrence were seasoned professionals, and I was, 25 years old, and he thought it would be a good learning experience for me, and he was right.
West Side Story was about gangs. You were from an upper-middle-class family. Was it hard to...
No, it wasn't really about gangs. It was about... Well, really, it's about the theater is what West Side Story is about.
And about the theater?
Yeah. It's about theater techniques. It's not really about gangs. That's the story. That it's Romeo and Juliet. It is, and it's just a transposition of Romeo and Juliet. So, gangs indeed it was. But the only research that was done was Jerry Robbins went to a dance, which there were two rival gangs, and he noticed that one gang gave carnations to each of the girlfriends, and so he used that. Up until the dress rehearsal of West Side Story in Washington, where in the dance hall sequence, all the sharks the girls gave the guys flowers, is what it was, and they put them in the cuffs of their trousers. And what Jerry hadn't realized was as soon as they would start dancing all over the stage became awash in flowers. It looked like a funeral. And so that was cut. But that was the only authentic moment, which was swiftly taken out. Arthur Lawrence very early on realized that there was no point in trying to be realistic about gang language, for example, because slang and argot, as you know, change every 2 months, and he knew that by the time we got the show on, any authentic talk he made would be outdated, so he made up all the language. And that's what we all decided to do, that the whole show should really be about imagination. Jerry indeed did some research and used to post things backstage for the cast on various gang incidents that would occur during the course of the rehearsals to give the actors some sense of the social milieu from which the characters came. But as far as we, the authors, went, we did no research at all.
Those are the first lyrics you wrote that got performed on Broadway. They've become classics. When you listen back to them, how do you feel about them?
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, you know, they're very self-conscious. But that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic. And his idea of poetic and mine are different. And I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young. And so I find, you know, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics for
that. That was the next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
No, first of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of followed the lyrics. That say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. In fact, I never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three. But once in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe in, though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose when I write lyrics. I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric. A whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note. Like he wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern. When you, Who stole my heart away. Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric because you've got to find a word where the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
You started doing music and lyrics. You started doing your own shows. The first was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
That was right after Gypsy.
And the second was Anyone Can Whistle. Forum was, I think, a big success. Whistle closed pretty soon. Mm-hmm. What was the effect of a failure on your career early on after you'd had so many successes?
Well, and then so many successes. Forum, yes, but West Side and Gypsy.
They weren't all yours.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Forum was a big success, although I got terrible reviews. Everybody, the reviews were almost unanimous in saying the show was a success in spite of what I had done. So I hadn't had any success.
Uh-huh.
I was only disappointed that more people wouldn't get to see Anyone Can Whistle. I was always wondering what would happen when I had my first so-called failure, but I realized since the others weren't personal successes anyway, because I got slammed by the critics for both West Side and Gypsy. They said how terrible the lyrics were, and then when I wrote music, they said the music was even worse than the lyrics. So I was used to getting slammed, so that had no effect on me. But the short run of the show depressed me because I wanted more people to see it.
When you started writing your own music, did you feel like you were carrying on the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein in any way, or did you feel like you were breaking from that?
Oh, no, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, certainly, absolutely.
What about what they had done felt like what you were doing? What is the tradition exactly?
Oh, it's a tradition. It's something Oscar really started with Showboat. It's he combined the whole European operetta idea with the American musical comedy idea. And the American musical comedy idea was, you know, a series of songs with jokes in between. And the operetta idea was a series of, you know, Graustarkian situations with outlandish romantic variations on them. And essentially an excuse for singers to let forth with large romantic or choral pieces. And with Showboat, he attempted to bring some realism into the musical theater and to combine the two so that they became what you could call a musical play. Not an opera, but a musical play. And somewhere between an operetta and a musical comedy. And that was not taken up very much by other people during the 30s, and Oscar tried a few himself, and they failed. So it wasn't until Oklahoma came along and was such a gigantic success that the movement was resuscitated. And after that, virtually everybody started to write what they call integrated musicals, in which the songs carry the story forward instead of just being respites and moments between jokes and block comedy scenes. And that's essentially what I was doing.
I want to play one piece that you've written, and this is from your opera Sweeney Todd. And I thought it might be interesting to...
It's nice to call it an opera, but please, let's call it a musical.
Call it a musical. Yeah, why would you prefer that to opera?
Well, because it doesn't belong in an opera house. Though it's mostly sung, there's a good deal of dialogue in it, and I'd say about 20% is dialogue. And it's not for operatic voices. It's not about the singer. Operas are about the singer, not about the opera.
Yeah, why don't you like to write for operatic voices, by the way?
Because they push it. They're interested in the voice and not in the material. And I'm interested in the material. And that's just the way they're trained, and that's what audiences come to hear. Audiences do not come to hear the piece, they come to hear the singers.
Well, from Sweeney Todd, what I've chosen to play is a part called The Epiphany, and this is a part where the whole character of the main character changes. Throughout the show, he's been interested in revenge against one person, and it's a kind of just revenge that he's seeking. But when his revenge is thwarted, he becomes pathological and is interested in killing anybody who enters his barbershop. He'll take any head that walks in. This is a turning point. Before we hear it, just tell me a little bit about the challenge that writing this presented to you.
Well, the piece is based on a play by an English playwright named Christopher Bond, an excellent version of this story, which has been told for 130 years, 150 now. And it's always been a kind of 19th century melodrama with blood and guts and thunder sheets, and as such it was always very uninteresting till this young playwright, Christopher Bond, a British playwright, got hold of it in the 70s. He was with an acting troupe, and they were going to put it on for their Christmas show, and they read it. The scripts arrived a little late, and they read it, and they only had 3 weeks to go, and they realized how terrible even the last version was, which would have been, I think, 1956 was the last version that was written. So he said, don't worry about it, I'll rewrite it. And he rewrote it, and he changed, kept the essential plot, which is about a murderer, mass murderer, and who kills people in his barber chair, and whose colleague, Mrs. Lovett, turns them into meat pies and becomes the most successful entrepreneur of meat pies in London as a result. And he motivated it by giving Sweeney Todd this whole revenge motive, which was never, ever part of the story. And the only difficulty he had in motivating the whole play was turning the personal revenge into mass revenge, which, of course, didn't matter in the originals, because in the originals he was just this kind of crazed, greedy murderer who killed people for their money. And that was not the case with Bond's version. And I had to figure out some reason to justify the moment. Bond justified the moment with a single sentence, which even he admitted was sort of a weak stem, which Sweeney said, in effect, "I've tasted blood, and now my thirst is great." And I'd never bought that, and neither, I think, did Chris Bond. So I tried to think of a reason that he would turn from being a single-minded murderer into this kind of crazed mass murderer. And I came up with this notion in The Epiphany, which has to do with the social situation and really has to do with the lower classes and the upper classes, which is something that Bond, who was and is a sort of left-wing playwright, had touched on but hadn't used for this particular moment. And what Sweeney does, in effect, is blame the world for his difficulties, for his problems, for the rape and suicide of his wife. And, in fact, he's right. And so to blame the social structure for his personal tragedy gave me the key so that he could then say, and now I will kill everybody in the social structure, high and low. And that's what it amounts to.
Okay, let's hear the part where he has this revelation, this epiphany. This is from Sweeney Todd.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Love, tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Though we all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you, sir. How about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, greeters. Sir, anybody, gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor 10 men, nor 100 can assuage me. I will have you. And I will get him back, even as he gloats. Time I'll practice on less honorable throats, and my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm full of joy.
The epiphany from Sweeney Todd. I love the lyric for this, and I think it's rough language for Broadway and a rough sentiment for Broadway as well. Can I just quote some of it in case people
sure.
missed it? If you don't mind me doing this. There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it, but not for long. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Can you tell me anything about writing that?
No,
they all deserve to die. Tell you why.
Well, first of all, it picks up the whole there's a hole in the world like a great black pit. Stop is a pickup of a theme that he sings earlier in mm-hmm. the show. The epiphany actually combines a number of themes, including the Dies Irae, which is an underlying yeah. motif of the whole show, and which is when the chugging vamp comes in there. That's what's being played hidden in the orchestra is the Dies Irae. And it's the first open statement, because the other references to the Dies Irae in the show are either sequential or not quite, but this is the first time it actually locks in. As far as that lyric goes, no, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just stating it. He's saying we're all lost in the social structure. There is no hope for the world. It's a Dickensian view, which is, you know, in fact, Hal Prince staged it so that the rich folk were always kind of on an upper level looking down at the poor folk. And what he's saying is that in such a structure, everybody loses. You know, it's this kind of structure that breeds revolution, which is in fact what Sweeney is doing. He's got a one-man revolution. He is the French Revolution by himself. He's killing not just the rich, of course. He's killing indiscriminately. He's killing everybody. But that's what he means by "we all deserve to die," even you, even I. I mean, as he says, there are only two ways, one on top and one on the bottom, and they're both, the ones on top should be killed and the ones on bottom get killed.
I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Stephen Sondheim. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Composer Stephen Sondheim is my guest. You don't orchestrate your own music.
No.
And most of your music has been orchestrated by Jonathan Tunick.
Since Company, yes, with exception of Sunday in the Park.
How much information do you have on your piano sheet when you give it to your orchestrator?
It's extremely complete because I was trained classically, so all the lines are in there. All that stuff is in there. The orchestrator adds nothing except chooses the instruments, and occasionally, because the piano is my instrument, Jonathan will have to take a piano figuration and make it sound in the orchestra, which is not always as easy as it might seem. And he will sometimes supply sustained lines, usually high up, not in this piece, but in some of the ballad pieces, because I keep forgetting that that when a note doesn't sustain on the piano, you know, when you've got your foot on the sustaining pedal and it goes off, I keep forgetting that a violin can make it go on, so I always strike the note again. And so Jonathan will occasionally do that, but no, I'm meticulous and careful about all the contrapuntal stuff.
The laugh that we heard in the Epiphany, was that written in to your
score? No, as a matter of fact, no, I'd worked it out so that because he was going to be on this sort of second floor where his barbershop is and then come down. Originally, I wanted him to sing it all up there. And Hal Prince, the director, said he wanted to bring him downstage. Well, in order to bring him downstage, we had to get him down a flight of stairs and onto the apron of the stage. And I had one passage where he could do that to get down, but I didn't really have a passage for him to go up. That is to say, there was a pause in the music, but in order to cover the cross to the staircase so it wouldn't seem like dead air, Len, I don't know whether, because it happened during rehearsal, I don't know whether Hal suggested it to Len or whether Len Carey, the guy who plays Sweeney, or whether it was Len's idea, but there was this kind of insane laugh. It's not my favorite moment because it's just vaguely, just vaguely camp to have a villain go, eh, eh, eh. But we needed something to cover the cross, and that's how that happened.
I think it's terrific.
Len is so frightening in the performance. It works, but in the hands of a less good actor, an insane laugh is high school stuff.
You know, it seems to me that in all your songs, you always bring in very specific elements of the drama.
I'm into sort of naturalistic songwriting, and like The Worst Pies in London. In that show, I worked out where she's dusting, blowing dust off her pies and slapping roaches and things like that. It's all worked into the music. Each slap and each blow, and I like working that kind of thing. And it first of all, it helps the director to give him a very specific blueprint of what the action should be, so that if he wants to change it, he can. But he has something to work from, and he doesn't have to turn to you and say, "Well, how do I fill this moment?" And I like to. I think it's fun to. To write songs, for people who have colds or who stutter or, who cough or who can't remember what they're saying, the kinds of things we do in real life.
Is that why you like to work in the setting of Broadway shows? Because there are details of a story to work into a song. It's not just a generic love song. There's characters. There's movements to
Broadway shows usually are generic. It's the rare Broadway show that doesn't. Why do you say Broadway? You said, I like to work in.
No, I mean, as opposed to just writing songs.
Oh,
writing songs.
Oh, you don't mean Broadway. You mean dramatic structure.
Dramatic structure. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. That's exactly why. Yes, I'd much rather write for character and situation. I wouldn't know how to just write a song because I would have to invent a character in a situation if you asked me to write a song. The few songs I've written, like, for, I know, people's birthdays and things like that, that I've written apart from dramatic situations, I've had to invent the dramatic situation or take it out of a real-life situation.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
I've taken it. Yes, I have. When I think the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character, I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes, not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it. When I think that it's either out of character, or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, the lyric goes by at its speed, and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time, not lag behind them, nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air, and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve it. Same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But at any rate, there are fewer words. And therefore, each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next, they don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue, and that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat, and that's what working out a puzzle is.
One last question. A lot of composers really love to play their own stuff at parties and to get on the stage whenever anyone will let them and perform. You seem to rarely perform your own work. You don't like to perform?
No, I don't. I played a lot. I performed a lot when I was a kid. When I was in the when I was at George School, I played some recitals around Pennsylvania, and I also acted a lot while I was in college, and one day I just woke up and thought, what am I doing in public? And from then on, I always wanted to hide in the shadows. I'm not a performer by nature, and except privately. I like to play the piano for friends, particularly for a collaborator. I like to demonstrate a song, but I do it when I have to, but it's something that does not give me a kick at all.
Well, I thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Righto.
Stephen Sondheim is in Philadelphia today, teaching at the Penn at Penn program. That's a lecture series co-sponsored by the University of Pennsylvania and Penn, the International Writers Organization. Sondheim's current hit musical, Into the Woods, is in its second year on Broadway. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with film director Taylor Hackford. His new film, Everybody's All American, stars Dennis Quaid and Jessica Lange. His work ranges from last year's tribute to Chuck Berry, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, to An Officer and a Gentleman. I hope you can join us.
Who knows what may be lurking on the journey? Into the woods to get the thing that makes it worth the journey. Into the woods to see the king, to sell the cow.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lauren Schoenberg's obsessions with language and memory led him to write about the brain. He wrote a nonfiction book about a brain surgeon, but his new book is a novel about a brain surgeon who diagnoses his own brain disorder. Coming up, Memories of Amnesia. Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, Tom Petty, and Jeff Lynne have just recorded as a group, or should I say supergroup, under the name The Traveling Wilburys. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Cry in the Dark, starring Meryl Streep. It's based on the true story of an Australian woman accused of murder after her baby disappeared under mysterious circumstances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Reagan administration today urged the Supreme Court to reverse its landmark Roe v. Wade decision that gave women the right to have an abortion. The Justice Department request came in a friend of the court brief filed in a Missouri abortion case now pending before the High Court. It's the Reagan administration's second formal request that the court overturn the 1973 abortion ruling. The Energy Department today named a site in Texas for eventual construction of the government's superconducting supercollider. Texas was one of six states named finalist for the giant atom smasher project. The governor of one of the five losing states is demanding answers about whether the selection of Texas was based on more than just scientific considerations. From Raleigh, North Carolina, Adam Hochberg reports.
Governor Jim Martin says North Carolina will insist on a full audit of the selection process to learn how the competing states were judged and whether politics played a role. Martin, a Republican, reminded reporters that President-elect George Bush, House Speaker Jim Wright, and powerful Senator Lloyd Benson all hail from Texas. But Martin also stressed he's not making any accusations, merely raising what he calls unavoidable questions about the Department of Energy selection process.
If we find that these questions cannot be satisfactorily answered, and I think there'll have to be a congressional review of how it came up with the decision it had, and there may be some time that gets a chance to work itself out through the process.
Martin adds, though, that he has no plans to stand in the way of construction of the supercollider. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Complaints about the selection of Texas have also been voiced by Arizona Senator Dennis DeConcini, who today announced that he has written to President Reagan and President-elect Bush asking for an independent investigation of the review procedures used to choose Texas for the supercollider. In the wake of the shutdown of some of the nation's nuclear weapons plants, the Energy Department opened hearings today on a proposal to build new ones. Details from Jill Hoyt of member station KBSA.
Most of the people testifying at the hearings in Twin Falls, Idaho today oppose the new nuclear weapons plant the Energy Department wants to build at the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory. They worry this new tritium plant could pollute the Snake River aquifer. This groundwater is already exposed to a plutonium leak from nuclear waste stored improperly in the 1970s. Tritium is used to trigger nuclear weapons, and because it decays rapidly, supplies need to be replenished often. Idaho Senator James McClure says the nation needs the new weapons plant to secure nuclear deterrence. But Milton Honig of the Nuclear Control Institute says a lower tritium supply should be used as a negotiating tool in arms reduction. Other critics of the new weapons plant say it's more important to clean up the nation's existing nuclear waste before creating more. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyt in Twin Falls, Idaho.
Searchers have found no sign of 27 missing crewmen from a Liberian tanker that caught fire and split in two in the North Atlantic early this morning. The ship broke apart in stormy seas and caught fire, spreading burning oil over the ocean's surface. So far, searchers have found only two burned and empty lifeboats. A Canadian military plane flew over the wreckage of the Liberian-registered Odyssey and reported that its bow was barely afloat. The stern sank after the vessel cracked in half. Canadian officials hold out little hope of finding survivors. The accident occurred about 1,000 miles east of Newfoundland. Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 3 points, finishing the day at 2114.69. Declines led advances 6-5 on volume of 127 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 3 cents. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. What do rock stars talk about over dinner? Well, one night this spring, George Harrison told his dinner companions, Roy Orbison, Jeff Lynne, and Tom Petty, that he needed another song for a record he was working on. The group decided to write one together, over at Bob's house. That's Bob Dylan. Over the next few weeks, the fivesome wrote enough songs for an entire album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of The Traveling Wilburys, Volume 1.
Everybody got somebody to lean on. Put your body next to mine and dream on. I've been uptight and made a mess, but I'll clean it up myself, I guess. Oh, the sweet smell of success.
The teaming of Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, Tom Petty, and the Electric Light Orchestra's Jeff Lynne as the Traveling Wilburys can only be called a revival of an outdated rock concept, the supergroup. Remember supergroups? It's a real 60s idea. Famous musicians band together to make a record and make a killing. The Blues Project, or Crosby, Stills & Nash, or Cream were kind of exciting, but they eventually became pretentious ripoffs like Blind Faith, a brief hype organized around Eric Clapton. Supergroups are a pretty stale, obnoxious idea by now. That's why there was no reason to suspect that the Traveling Wilburys would be any good at all. Yet this album is completely disarming, funny, ingratiating, and in its own world-weary, old pro way, quite passionate. That, of course, is Roy Orbison singing lead on Not Alone Anymore. Throughout this album, the stars trade lead vocals, everyone plays rhythm guitar, often all five at once, and the drumming of the great Jim Keltner keeps the old duffers driving forward. The record is an occasion for Roy Orbison to remind us he still has a great voice, for George Harrison to remind us he has a sense of humor, for Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne to remind us they're still alive, and for Bob Dylan to remind us that there is apparently no end to his amusing mean-spiritedness.
Congratulations for making me wait. Congratulations. Now it's too late. Congratulations. You came out on top. Congratulations. Never did know when to stop. Congratulations. Congratulations.
The best thing about this album is that it's a real collaboration, not just a collection of star turns. On the cut we just heard, Dylan's bitterness is sweetened nicely by Jeff Lynne's soaring keyboards and a whimsical guitar figure that's a clear George Harrison trademark. On other songs, the players toss vocal lines back and forth, and it's a real fan's treat hearing the way such famous voices sound when they clash or harmonize. As the album proceeds, particular themes emerge, the most pervasive of which is that hollow macho cliché, the loneliness of being a guy alone, and by implication, a star. Once again, however, your expectations are denied. Instead of being pathetically self-indulgent, the tribulations of solitary stardom seems to be the only idea that really moves these isolated rock veterans. And it results in the album's loveliest song, End of the Line.
Maybe somewhere down the road away,
the end of the line,
you'll think of me and wonder where I am these days.
At the end of the line, of the line.
Maybe somewhere down the road when somebody plays,
at the end of the line,
purple haze.
Well, it's all right, even when push comes to shove. Well, it's all right.
just glad to be here, happy to feel that. And it don't matter if you're by my side, I'm satisfied.
Well, it's all right.
As agreeable as this is, and I think that's a really good song, there's a lot that's awfully coy about this Wilbury act. They've all taken pseudonyms. Dylan is Lucky Wilbury, Orbison is Lefty Wilbury, and so on, as if they're the five dwarves. They are all real short guys, come to think of it. The liner notes are a cutesy unsigned narrative, a jokey history of the band. From the tone, I suspect they were written by the Monty Python member thanked on the record jacket, Michael Palin. It's said that while the Wilburys have no desire to tour, there's already a movie in the works, doubtless one of those mock documentaries like This Is Spinal Tap or The Ruddles. In other words, they're going to run this thing into the ground. Until that happens, however, we can enjoy this rare burst of rock and roll camaraderie as an unexpected pleasure.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
She's a worried owl, walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change, and I get the strangest feeling. Yes, I'm heading for the light.
This is Fresh Air. Shainberg's interest in exploring consciousness, language, and memory led him to write a novel about the brain. For research, he volunteered at a hospital for brain-damaged patients, and he ended up writing a nonfiction book about a brain surgeon before completing his novel. That novel, Memories of Amnesia, has just been published. The story is told from the perspective of a brain surgeon who is the first to diagnose the early symptoms of his own brain disorder. In a New York Times book review, Diane Johnson described it as a novel in which a consciousness reports on its own deterioration. I asked Shainberg to read an excerpt from the opening.
Brain damage is not always as grotesque as normal brains expect it to be. It's true that it can strike like a hurricane, but sometimes it's more like a gentle breeze, a subtle change of vectors that leaves you headed not in the opposite direction, but almost exactly where you were headed before. A charming eccentricity becomes obnoxious. Private habits go public. It gets a little harder to keep things to yourself. I've seen it begin with farting or belching, nose-picking, cursing, bragging, a lean to the left or a lean to the right. Too many adjectives, self-absorption, visions of grandeur, arrogance, dogmatism, indecision, or its opposite. In one patient, the first symptom his tumor produced was an inability to admit mistakes. Another qualified everything he said. It's only one man's opinion, but it seems to me that there's nothing the brain can't use when it turns against you.
Is that what you think this book is about, what happens when the brain turns against you?
I would say that, yes. I would say that it's almost inevitable with any condition, that any brain, that it's eventually going to turn against you, though.
Now, I assume that when you were writing this book, you didn't have a brain disorder yourself. But what made you so acutely aware of your brain thinking about itself, about you trying to understand your own brain through using your brain?
I don't know whether I would accept that I didn't have a brain disorder. I didn't have a clinical brain disorder, but I have a brain. And I'm not sure that you can have a brain without having a brain disorder. And that was that... was really the basis of the book.
Well, what kind of normal brain damage do you think you were suffering from or are suffering from?
Normal brain damage, for starters, to being a writer is an obsession with language, addiction to description, confusion about memory between the which divides the present from the past. Too much anticipation, too much desire, too much ambition. Any one of those could be called a brain disorder. according to my terminology anyhow.
You are using in your novel medical brain damage as a metaphor for the issues of consciousness that you are struggling with. When you presented some of these issues to actual neurosurgeons, what did they think? Did they think it was acceptable to use brain damage as a metaphor for the issues you were dealing with?
No, I don't think so. I would say that most of them would listen to me with a kind of bemusement and said it like one of them did, well, the question's interesting, but I wouldn't say it's high on my list of priorities.
Which question might they be referring to?
Well, I was talking about normal brain damage. I was talking about the distinction between the clinical brain damage and normal brain damage. And it's a subject that interests them, but they are dealing, after all, with a medical condition, a clinical condition, a catastrophic condition, and it's almost they would consider it an indulgence to think about it in the way I do.
I'd like to ask you to read a section of your novel that I think will give a sense of the kinds of struggles this character with the brain disorder has to go through. This is some of the problems of language and memory and connection that he has. Would you read the passage?
This is taking place, as you know, with during the surgery at the end of the book when he's working with his assistant and watching what's going on in the mirror. He's under local anesthetic, and he's talking about various ways that he tested himself using electrodes to measure different functions in his brain. Photographs could also activate other circuits in my brain. When I saw a lemon, I tasted it, and the taste produced the word. But when I was shown a baseball, I heard the crack of a bat, and then cried, not without conviction, "Hammer!" When Eli presented a schematic drawing of the sky with stars and planets labeled, I heard several bars of silent night, then saw Edward holding the doors of the elevator and could not stop the word, "Elevator!" Not all my mistakes had logic, however. Some, like Ranjit and Wellentush for a milk bottle and a kitten, were just babble, while others, like Airplane for a television set, seemed intentional, perverse, or both.
I think that passage brings up some of the challenges that writing this novel must have posed to you, because here you are writing about someone who's confusing all their language and is confusing the names of people, associates one word for the wrong object, and you had to find a way to write about all of this in a language that would show the confusion yet make some sense to the reader.
Well, it was a problem. I mean, it just about drove me crazy, if you want to know the truth. And it seems to me that if I erred in the book, I backed off from this. I didn't take it anywhere near as far as as brain damage can go, into disorder.
Was this book therapeutic at all, or did it drive you nuts when it was finished?
Well, things that drive you nuts can be therapeutic in a way. I think maybe that was the most therapeutic thing about it. It drove me beyond any sense of order. If you deal with brain damage in any even the most rudimentary way, it seems to me that it just reduces any conviction of knowledge, any ideas you have, to ashes. And that's what it did for me. And that's, as you know yourself, I'm sure it's frightening, but it's also that is therapy to me, liberating you from your own ideas.
One of the characters in your novel is interested in all Eastern thought. She studies karate. She sits in meditation. And there's this constant interplay in the book between a kind of almost Zen Buddhist sense of identity and the sense of consciousness that the neurosurgeon has in contemplating the brain, thinking about the brain. Have you studied Eastern philosophy as well as brain disorders?
Quite a bit. I mean, I would say that's probably the essential foundation of the book. I consider that the greatest neurologist were probably were spiritual masters, that they knew more and know more about the brain as a whole than any anyone who's approaching it in a scientific way. I make fun of it a little with the wife in the book. She's working on her brain in the same way that her husband, who's the neurosurgeon, is working on his. They're just taking different paths. But, you know, I mean, anyone that deals with neurology, I think eventually has to accept that the line between it and what we call mysticism is not so clear. It's dealing with the line between what's visible and what's invisible and what's material and what's immaterial. It's dealing with first cause, you know, where the origin, how did this gesture originate, where in the brain did it originate, and then where did the cause for that particular pulse originate. What begins as a basically, easily, clearly defined scientific question quickly becomes, as I see it, spiritual or theological. Those questions drove me more than any other.
So what's your next project? Are you going to write about something very mechanical and factual?
I wish I could. I hope I can. I'm working on a novel that is, I hope, that is broader in its comedy, and I hope a lot less ambitious than this one.
Right. Good luck.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lauren Schoenberg's novel Memories of Amnesia is published by Paris Review Editions. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Well, the election's over. Is there anything else to talk about?
Well, actually, there is. We've managed to come up with a full show today. We have a report on the stealth fighter. Now, you've heard about the stealth bomber for years, but today, for the first time, the Pentagon acknowledged that a stealth fighter exists, and it has existed for the last 5 years. Also, the Energy Department announced today that Texas has been selected as the site for construction of the world's largest atom smasher, the superconducting supercollider. Now, Congress hasn't yet approved the $4+ billion price tag, but Texas must be happy because it's the biggest and most expensive scientific device ever made, or will be, and it involves some 3,500 construction jobs.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A Cry in the Dark is the new film from director Fred Skepsy. His previous movies include Roxanne, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, and Barbarossa. Film critic Stephen Schiff says A Cry in the Dark tells a powerful and complex story.
Maybe you saw it on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago. The story of Lindy Chamberlain, the Australian woman who claimed that when she and her husband were on a 1980 camping trip, a dingo, a kind of Australian wild dog, entered her tent and made off with her baby. An inquest acquitted her of any responsibility for the baby's disappearance, but the Australian public didn't. Lindy and her husband, Michael, were Seventh-day Adventists, and soon rumors were sweeping Australia that Lindy had murdered her child in some weird cultic rite, that the baby's name, Azaria, meant sacrifice in the wilderness, that Michael's stiff religious pronouncements and Lindy's oddly chilly behavior were evidence of their foul play. Overzealous police brought the case to trial, and before Lindy knew it, she was serving a life sentence for murder. But Lindy was innocent. As the courts admitted only this last September, she was the victim of a kind of natural disaster, a volcanic eruption of viciousness on the part of the Australian press and public. It sounds like the stuff of which very bad, or very corny, movies are often made. But what's nearly as remarkable as the case itself is the extraordinarily intelligent and powerful film that the Australian director Fred Skepsy has derived from it. A Cry in the Dark is a completely original, uncompromising, and horrifically moving portrait of evil, of the kind of banal evil Hannah Arendt wrote about, evil that results from men's peculiar ability to surge together and drown the mild voice of conscience. Lindy made it easy for them. She was so cranky and dislikable and odd. And in a brilliant performance, Meryl Streep reinvents her from the ground up. Here she is during her trial, 7 months pregnant, and in no mood to make nice.
You say the blood on the parka must have come from the baby?
Yes.
When it was in the dog's mouth?
Somewhere around that time.
But what other time could it have come from the
baby? Look, Mr. Barker, I wasn't there. I can only go on the evidence of my own eyes. We're talking about my baby daughter. Not some object.
Streep makes no particular effort to turn Lindy into a dewy heartbreaker. And as her husband, Sam Neill gives a performance that's just as brave and prickly and uningratiating, all of which has the paradoxical effect of making the Chamberlain's plight much more moving than it could have been if Skepsi had allowed them to tug at our tear ducts. He's a marvelous director. In brief scenes scattered throughout the main narrative, Skepsi captures every segment of Australian society, reveling in the Chamberlain's misfortune, all in a way that's totally unsensational and completely convincing. Nothing in the case or the behavior of the participants has been softened or simplified, and Skepsi's gorgeously vaulting, swirling camera keeps us spinning from one encounter to another, until in the end he's constructed a rich portrait of an entire society, indeed of contemporary democratic societies everywhere. In the wake of a particularly brutish presidential campaign, one in which the public's hunger for innuendo and name-calling always seems so much greater than its hunger for the truth, A Cry in the Dark feels especially potent. It offers pity and terror, this movie, the stuff of tragedy. And the tragedy is not just Australia's, it's ours as well.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with art critic Calvin Tompkins. He says in the 1980s, art formed more intimate alliances with finance and fashion, and corporations became the new Medicis, and that's distracted some people from the real question about any art object: is it any good? Also, new music composer and accordionist Guy Klisevic performs excerpts from his tribute to polka music, Polka from the Fringe. He's performing the entire work next week at the Next Wave Festival in the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Hotel Terminus, Marcel Ofel's film on Nazi Klaus Barbie. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.